History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Perhaps no founding father was more of a Renaissance man than Benjamin Franklin. He invented swim fins, the catheter, the lightning rod, a stove that would easily and cheaply heat a house. He was a postmaster, a librarian, a fire chief, a printer, a militia member, and a diplomat who architected the military alliance between France and the United States that led to victory in the Revolutionary War. Franklin also had incredible foresight. For example, when he heard about the hot air balloon tests in France, he saw a potential for aerial combat, but perhaps his most far-reaching action was to leave a gift in his will of £2,000 to be lent out to jumpstart the careers of small business owners in Boston and Philadelphia over the next two centuries. Each loan would be repaid with interest over 10 years, and if all went according to plan, the accrued final payout in 1991 would be a windfall to be spent on civic improvements. Sort of sounds like Harry Seldon in Isaac Asimov's Foundation. Today's guest is Michael Meyer, and he's the author of the book Benjamin Franklin's Last Bet, The Favorite Founder's Divisive Death, Enduring Afterlife, and Blueprint for American Prosperity. In this episode, we discuss the evolution of these twin funds as they age along America itself, bankrolling woodworkers and silversmiths, trade schools, and space races. Over time, Franklin's wager was misused, neglected, and contested, but it was never completely extinguished. So we see about which loans were effective, which loans failed, what happened with the final payout in 1991, and what Franklin himself would make about the legacy of his wager. Would he think that it was money well spent, that it was a colossal failure, or something else in between? Franklin is one of my favorite people to discuss, and there's just so much about his life that is fascinating. And as you can see, his death is equally as fascinating. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with Michael Meyer. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
Well, I've come across Mr. Franklin many times in this podcast series, and it's always a delight to learn about him and what a merry prankster he was, how inventive, how creative he was. And well, I suppose we should start with his career because he did so many different things, from diplomat to printer to volunteer fire chief to anything, any profession you could imagine or describe in the 18th century. So first of all, can you tell me about what he did during his career that would make him understand all the different types of work that one could do in the small business worlds of Boston and Philadelphia in the 18th century?
Yeah, that's a great way to start off. Thanks for that, Scott. You know, Franklin was his dad, let's kind of back this up. He sort of evinces the notion that the person who is engaged with the street best knows the foundations of one's democracy. So what I mean by that is, as a child in Boston, if he had walked out of his home on Union Street and gone down to the Long Wharf, he constantly would have been passing by tradespeople. His father was a skilled dyer who came over from England and immigrated to Boston and realized that in order to feed his family in a town like Boston, where they were then grazing cows on the common, selling fine cloth was not going to cut it. And so he became a candle maker, became a chandler. And so Franklin grew up around his father in a trade, you know, walking again to the wharf, watching people using their hands. He said in his autobiography that it always made him happy to see workers handling their tools. And then he was apprenticed to his older brother as a printer, working at his brother's paper, the New England Courant, and quickly learned that he hated it. He hated working for his brother. And so absconded and broke his indentures and headed off to what he'd hoped to be New York at age 17, but ended up in Philadelphia. And then, you know, we'll go through this in this conversation, but really worked many different jobs and came into contact with many different Philadelphians and then British people when he worked in London to get understanding of how important trades were to make a living in a society without social safety nets.
Absolutely. And something that he does, the focus of your book, his bet, the funds that he leaves behind in order to jumpstart the careers of other small business owner in Boston and Philadelphia. Something that is interesting about this is that Franklin was a man ahead of his time in many ways, but Something that I've read about him and in his writings is that he was one of the early people who really had an understanding of progress, that what's going to happen in the future, the world is moving, technology is compounding upon itself. And as an Enlightenment thinker, he's getting beyond maybe a medieval understanding of time, that things might be moving cyclically, but they're not really progressing upward and onward. But he does understand this, and he mentions, and he even writes, I think, some speculation about what could happen in the world in 50, 100 years. And so I wonder, how does that perhaps affect his idea to bequeath this inheritance to future businessmen and the civil society of Boston and Philadelphia?
So just to recap, you know, Franklin added a codicil to his will when he was dying, about 10 months before he died. He decided to change one of his bequests. And he changes this bequest to say, okay, I'm going to take two pots of money, essentially, and leave one to Boston and one to Philadelphia. And from this pot of money, I expect virtuous citizens to step forward and manage for free a small loan program that will dole out, you know, 60 pounds. These were quite small loans at the time, but enough to hang your shingle out. I want to dole out these small loans to young tradesmen in order to repay the people who gave me a helping hand in Philadelphia. He immediately negates the idea that he was a self-made man. And these loans were going to be repaid over a period of 10 years. They were at 5% interest. So some people consider him a forerunner of microfinance. And his notion was that, you know, this was going to be for the common good, and that every entrepreneur was going to repay the loan. And then that would increase the overall fund to lend to other, you know, burgeoning entrepreneurs. And then after 100 years of this, talk about foresight, he said, I'm going to, you know, there's going to be a large pot of money here that's going to accrue. And I want Boston and Philadelphia to each take a large chunk of that, 100 of 131 shares, 100,000 pounds, he thought at that time. And I want you to decide as a society, as a city, to build something for the common good or to make the city more agreeable to strangers. But he wasn't done there. Then he said, look, I want you to reinvest that last 31,000 pounds that should remain, if my projections are correct. And you're going to loan it out to tradesmen again for the next 100 years. And by the year 1991, when this 200-year anniversary of this loan scheme beginning comes around, if America is still standing, if Boston and Philadelphia are still there, you're going to have this windfall, this jackpot that you can then dole out again to build something for the common good. Now, where did this idea come from? I want to go back to what you had asked originally. You know, Franklin said that it's strange that those who live by shifts can seldom shift themselves. He, you know, came of age at a time when it was, if you were not moneyed, if you didn't have capital, it might be difficult to start your trade. And you could be one fire away from total ruin. You could be one bad debtor away from total ruin. And so he wanted this to be a way to provide a sort of safety net for people in his class.
I'm curious, do we have a sense of what Franklin expected would happen? He set the terms, as you described, of how the money would be used. Did he imagine that this would, I don't know, if we take the optimistic scenario planning of Kiva and other microloan industries, where they will start the engines right of capitalism and poverty will cease to exist, and everybody from the, you know, poor Irish farmer to the savage Indian, and I'm speaking in Franklin era parlance, of course, listeners, would basically be able to start a business, and the Yeomanry and the Jeffersonian vision of industry and craft would spread across the virgin lands of North America as far as the eye could see. So I don't know, what did Franklin imagine? And if he didn't say anything, what do you think he was thinking?
Well, he was wrong in one huge respect. He did not see the coming Industrial Revolution. And so he passes in 1790. 5 years earlier, he had seen a demonstration of the steamboat by the inventor John Fitch on the Delaware River. And Franklin was not impressed with what he saw and decided not to invest, which probably was an indication more of John Fitch's design than it was the steam and the gears themselves. But one thing he definitely did not see was that the sort of trades that he was backing, your cordwainers or shoemakers, you know, bootmakers, small manufacturers and so forth, were soon going to be replaced by mechanized labor. He dies, you know, before James Watt. He dies before Eli Whitney. This is all in the 1790s and early 1800s. He dies before the massive expansion of the United States, of course, under the Louisiana Purchase. And he dies, you know, 12, 13 years before James Lowell goes over and sees James Watt's steam machines and memorizes their design because if he had written down the designs, he would have been prosecuted. He knew his notes were going to be searched. And Lowell comes back to Massachusetts and says, oh, this is great. Now we have this invention called the cotton gin. We're going to have these bales of cotton and come up here to Massachusetts, and I'll employ people in these large machines and these looms, right, to mass produce cotton goods. So Franklin failed to see all of that. But what he wasn't wrong about, and I don't want to give the ending of this book away, what he wasn't wrong about is that America was going to need skilled labor. Now, that could mean bricklayer, a mason, a carpenter. That could also mean someone who's installing and maintaining HVAC systems. As a president of a trade school told me, you know, people say like robots are replacing skilled workers. Well, we're training the workers to repair those robots. So in that regard, we are still skilled workers because the tools of engineering haven't changed since Franklin's time. So on the one hand, I don't think he clearly didn't foresee that the apprentice system that he loved was going to pass, you know, the way he saw it was going to change into something else. But at the same time, he wasn't wrong in that skilled workers or young people who wanted to learn a trade were not going to have the same opportunities as those moneyed kids and young people that wanted to go into academia. And, you know, he had seen, I don't think it's a coincidence that this money that he uses to stake these loans, the source of it came from the salary he forswore when he was appointed governor, which was called president then of Pennsylvania for 3 years, because he believed very strongly that politicians should not be paid. And he tried to convince the Constitutional Convention delegates to believe in this. He said, if you allow people to pursue these offices for profit, their greed and avarice is going to take over and these men will become your rulers. So he pointedly in his will said that money that I did not accept for my salary as governor of Pennsylvania, that's going to go to staking these workers. At the other hand, though, before he died, he wrote a lengthy rebuke to the Pennsylvania Academy, which is the school he helped found in Philadelphia. It's today's University of Pennsylvania, where he lamented the fact that the school that he had founded for practical learning had turned into a finishing school for the blue bloods of Philadelphia. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the 2,000 pound figure he chose to stake this loan scheme was the same amount that he had raised to start the Philadelphia Academy. Franklin might be, you know, the most famous philanthropist to leave nothing to a university in his will, let alone the university that he helped found.
Just another reason to respect Franklin, that there was no bigger enemy of the foppish dandy class than him in the 18th century. So just another reason to like him if you needed any more. I'm curious, does he say anything about what he's speculating the massive civic payout in 1991 would be? I'm thinking about when Franklin talked about the future, I believe he was quite enamored with the hot air balloon and the experiments in France. Would you think there'd be a massive hot air balloon port built and that would be the source of international travel by the far future of the 20th century? Or does he say anything at all about that?
Legend has it that when he witnessed a demonstration of the hot air balloon in Paris, somebody scoffed, "What good is it?" And Franklin's response is reportedly, "Well, what good is a newborn baby?" I do say in the book, I think it's fascinating that his son sent and his grandson received the first airmailed letter. What's credited as the first airmailed letter, his son William was a loyalist, was exiled in London, and he sent by hot air balloon, a letter over to his son Temple, who was then staying with Franklin in Paris. You know, you mentioned too, like his antipathy for the foppish class. Speaking of Paris, when he presented himself at court with his, you know, unpowdered long shoulder length hair and not wearing the same clothes as the other diplomats, Marie Antoinette had asked, "Who is that?" You know, she had heard of him, but she asked her courtier, you know, what's his background? And when the guy tells her, well, you know, he was a printer and he was an apprentice before that, and Marie Antoinette reportedly sniffed, in France, he would have risen to be nothing more than a bookseller. So Franklin was very aware of that. And I think he paraded that and played that to his advantage. I discovered this story while wearing an ill-fitting suit. And as I was sweating through it at an official event, I really did admire him, you know, that we should list business casual among his inventions. You know, you asked, what did he envision for 1991? It's really difficult to do historical conversions of money, but the figures he left behind were that he was leaving 1,000 pounds each to Boston and Philadelphia. The U.S. dollar was not yet official currency. That didn't happen until 1792. And so again, it reminds us too about how much foresight or how willing he was to make this bet at a time when U.S. financial, the U.S., our country, let alone our financial institutions, were floundering. They were quite fledgling. The stock market didn't, you know, the stock exchange didn't begin until 1792 as well. So £1,000 in 1790 is equivalent to $4,444. We can get into the weeds about what that actually was at the time, what it purchased. But he had intended that that £1,000 within 100 years would multiply to £131,000. And then by 1991, he predicted that would multiply to £4 million, all the while staking, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of independent entrepreneurs over those 200 years. So he really did expect it to become a windfall.
It's hard not to get sidetracked with all the favorite little, you know, stories of Franklin. And you mentioned how he carried himself at the French court. And I read an account, and this is one of my favorite, is that a French instructor looked at his level of the French language, and it was absolutely appalling. His spoken French would be maybe a C minus. His written French was an F. Yet despite that, he architected the French-American military alliance, despite sounding like a, you know, poorly grammared Arnold Schwarzenegger in a foreign language. So someone who's lived overseas, I've been inspired by the fact that you don't have to really have a high level of foreign language. You just have to have a lot of gusto and gumption. You can really go far. But back to your topic at hand.
Oh, I was going to say that I think what you just said about the gusto, though, he played by the French court's rules. And a lot of the sniffy huffiness of John Adams, you know, saying that Franklin is the pampered favorite of the court, came from the fact that Adams would show up to his desk at 8 a.m. or 9 a.m., not realizing that the business of the court was taking place at 11 p.m. to 2 a.m., right? That Franklin knew how to play that game. And he's doing this as an elderly man with two, you know, a teenage grandson in tow, along with his younger grandson. You know, he's suffering from gout and everything else. And he's widowed at that time. And he feels quite cut off from the American leadership. He's sniping with them about expenses and so forth. But Franklin played by their rules and curried favor with the court that way.
Well, to get to your book topic at hand, I'm curious, in the early years after Franklin passes away and this fund is set up, who administers it? And how are these loans first handed out? By what criteria do people receive them? And how are they used?
So he expected in his will that the stipulation was that none of his principal can be spent on overhead. So there can't be an office or anything like that. And fund managers can't be paid. He expected benevolent, virtuous citizens to step forward and be willing to manage this for free. Ads were placed in the Massachusetts Sentinel and the Pennsylvania Gazette. And then his grandson, Benny, who had inherited his printing press and started a newspaper called the Aurora in Philadelphia, he printed up loan agreements. It was a standard printed agreement. It's fascinating to hold these. You can read them at the Boston City Archives and at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia. Pre-printed agreements, applicant had to be, had to have finished their apprenticeship in that city, in Boston or in Philadelphia, had to be at least 25 years old, and had to be married. Franklin, it wasn't a coincidence, I think, was married by the age of 25, although it was a common law marriage to his wife, Deborah, who I write about quite a bit in the book too. And so they had to have two sureties back, or two guarantors for their loan. And again, at this time, the dollar is a nascent currency. And so Franklin required that these loans are backed by Spanish milled gold dollars. The terms were 10 years. And then the idea was is that you would take out, say, a 60-pound loan. They were set at a smaller amount. And then you would have to show that you were establishing your business and then pay annually at 5% interest.
Did it work in the beginning? The people who received these loans, were they able to start the sort of businesses or ventures that Franklin hoped would happen with these funds?
It did. And, you know, it's fun to flip through these crinkly yellow pages of the ledger and see, you know, the first person to receive a loan in Boston was a bricklayer. The first person to receive a loan in Philadelphia was a shoemaker. And as you flip the pages, you sort of see, it's almost like watching a Minecraft world be constructed in front of you, because here comes a bricklayer and here comes a glazier. Here comes a candle maker and a distiller and a saddler, a hairdresser, a baker, a jeweler, right? All these trades are marching along through the pages as they're building up their trade. So in the early going, in the first 10 years, it was quite successful. But then comes the War of 1812, the Great Panic of 1819, a lot of the technological innovations I had talked about, plus the building of the Erie Canal, which opens around 1820, and that starts starving Philadelphia's port. of business that it had before. The capital moves from Philadelphia to Washington, on and on and on. There's a lot of changes that start happening outside the ken of his will that obviously he couldn't foresee that starts to disrupt his scheme.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Is it able to correct itself after the War of 1812, after Philadelphia is neglected, or does it, the nature of these loans and I suppose the success that they have in starting businesses recover, or does it take a really weird turn from here on out?
Well, again, it's funny for a man who could, you know, a man who could invent the catheter, the man who could invent swim fins, the man that could perfect the odometer and the rocking chair could not foresee, for example, that maybe people would be turning in counterfeit money for payment and that would ding the loan. And, you know, Franklin printed money. He designed the first currency that the United States was using, or the Continental Congress, the Confederate States was using, excuse me. So he, you know, didn't see that. And he also didn't seem to expect anyone to default. Because when you think back at his rapid rise, you know, he had met misfortune early in his career. He sailed over to London and thought that he was on an errand for the Pennsylvania governor. It turns out that the governor had no credit to give, and Franklin was marooned in London for a few years and had to earn his fare back to Philadelphia. You would think that he would have known that some people were cads and bounders and gold brickers and were going to take advantage of this and not pay it back. So there's a series, you know, I lay the book out chronologically. So we're following, I'm trying to create suspense on the page, right, with what happens to each fund, who's paying back, who isn't paying back. What happens, though, is that the two funds really diverge. Boston and Philadelphia end up managing their money really differently after 1820. And it sort of fits along with other massive changes that were going on in American society at that time. Boston was inventing trusts. Boston was inventing mutual funds. Boston was inventing estate managers. Philadelphia, on the other hand, was, you know, had elected as its mayor a record 16 times. He only served 14. A man who had a decided distaste for learning. You know, he proclaimed that. He had apprenticed to be a hatter. And they want to follow a different route, which is, I don't care if people are defaulting. Franklin wanted this money to go to working class people, so we're going to make sure it goes to working class people. Now, across the next 150, 170 years, there's twists and turns in this story, because sometimes things click and they start working in one city. Sometimes things fall apart and surprisingly stop working in another city.
It's interesting, when you first hear Franklin's plan, people might expect some sort of steampunk Harry Seldon from Isaac Asimov's Foundation series, where he plans for the next several hundred years and leads little, you know, future breadcrumbs with notes 30 years in the future, 50 years, 100 years in the future. And Isaac Asimov is a fun writer. I mean, I love cheeseball, golden age science fiction, but it looks like in practice, it's not as easy to predict the future with accuracy as he might have thought. If Franklin couldn't do it, then probably not many other people could do it as well. Did you get a sense one way or another that the official timeline starts to diverge from what Franklin originally envisioned?
In a strange way, no, because this whole, in the book, I have a refrain that goes through this, that every generation discovers Franklin for themselves, because he's constantly being discovered and put to use by new waves of immigrants, including Andrew Carnegie, who read his autobiography as a young man in Scotland, who came over to Pennsylvania when he was 13 years old, has a lot of similar traits with Franklin. You know, it's not a coincidence that Andrew Carnegie, when he turned to massive philanthropy, struck upon libraries, which of course Franklin had founded the first subscription library in the United States. But there's people that keep popping up in the narrative that are inspired by him. And those are large bankers like Thomas Mellon, who comes over from Ireland and starts the massive bank. Other people like James Gordon Bennett, who becomes a massive newspaperman, you know, the New York newspapers, who comes over or immigrates down from elsewhere in the United States. Throughout the story, I was struck by how many people were picking up Franklin's idea. It was almost like, you know, when you have a radio and you're driving and the static fades in and out. There are certain times in American history, these last 200 years, where people look to Franklin's example of, hey, we should try this. We should put stock in this. And sometimes that's a call to war. You know, like in Philadelphia, when it becomes one of the massive arsenal of democracies, where people start going, you know what? If Franklin was onto something here, and maybe we could use his fund for a different use. Maybe we could expand the notion of what an apprentice is or what a tradesperson is to include firefighters, to include nurses. Boston takes up a similar mantle later in the 20th century where they go, you know, we don't need a lot of cordwainers anymore or glaziers, but we have a lot of indebted people walking around our streets wearing scrubs. And maybe in some way, a physician who's trying to start his or her own practice is akin to the dentist of 200 years ago wanting to hang out their shingle. And so I was struck by how often these echoes of Frank would come down the across the centuries. I mean, you mentioned too, like the steampunk idea. You know, you see him credited now as a forerunner of the open source movement. You see, because he refused to patent his inventions. And although the patent office didn't really start until Thomas Jefferson was issuing patents as Secretary of State after Franklin died, he could have applied for, you know, sole commercial use for many of his inventions. He didn't want to do that. He said the point of technology is to make people's lives better and to be perfected by other people. He refused to put his name on his philanthropy. This is really different than how things are done today. You rarely walk into a building on a university campus named Anonymous, right? But Franklin, you know, in Philadelphia, half the city think, you know, institutions could have been named for him. It could have been the Franklin University. It could have been the Franklin Hospital. It could have been the Franklin Gazette and the Franklin Fire Brigade and the Franklin Street Cleaners and the Franklin Militia. He didn't want to do that. He thought that was distasteful. And so that in turn inspires people down the centuries who are giving to this fund in order to keep it going, but don't want their names associated or made public.
Are there any notable successes and failures that you see emerge from this fund?
I mean, the tangible successes you can walk into and visit today at the Franklin Institute of Technology in the south end of Boston, which is a remarkable trade school that has for the past 100 years been clinging to stay in operation, you know, across the Charles. Harvard has an endowment of 40 plus billion. The Franklin Institute is happy when it gets a donation of $1,000. You know, it received its largest donation in its history just last week from a family that gave $12 million to it. You know, so that's one marked success. The other thing I think that fascinates me about Pennsylvania and Philadelphia is people are still receiving Franklin's money. His money is still in play. If you want, you know, if you don't want to go to university, if you want to learn a trade, you can apply to receive a Franklin loan. That money is still going on today. You know, previously in history, Franklin loan recipients went on to become mayors. They went on to become judges. They went on to become congresspeople. And I think it says something that the Boston and Philadelphia media never propagandized this. They never promulgated this. There was never a concerted, you know, how now like charities and philanthropies have wonderful PR campaigns that always want to tell you how great they are and why you should give more to them. Franklin's loans didn't have that. And so a lot of these recipient success stories went unrecorded, which is why I came across this book. I thought, you know, it's time to write a book when the book you want to read doesn't exist. And when I came across Franklin's will and started reading about this, I thought, how does nobody know about this? You know, it's personal for me because my family's in construction and I'm the first person in my family to go to college. My mom can read blueprints and price a job. I can't do that. I think she's smarter than I am. But, you know, in our society today, people like that are looked down upon in general.
It's interesting. It's sort of like he came two centuries before Peter Thiel with the plan to give $100,000 to people who skipped college and then went off and tried to create something without this. I wonder, do you see a connective tissue with what Franklin was trying to do, leapfrogging over these traditional avenues of climbing, getting to the highest rung of society, with people today who are also questioning these older institutions and four-year degrees and other things that we traditionally say are the means by which you become white collar and achieve success in the United States?
That's a great question. And it's a bit hard to answer because Franklin, on the one hand, was an autodidact who always scratched the phantom limb of his missed education. He adored school. He got to go to 1 year at Boston Latin School. His father could not afford the books. And Franklin made sure in his will to leave money to that school and to award Franklin medals to the best achieving students, which are still issued. You know, and he says in his autobiography, all the money he ever gathered was spent on books. And he also admits quite cheekily that his first big philanthropic cause is to open a library in Philadelphia. And he said, I didn't tell anybody this, but when I was raising money for it, you know, I was going to be the prime beneficiary of this because I was always spending my non-working hours in the library reading as much as I can. So I think on the one hand, he'd be elated to see
young Americans eager to go to school and learn and get degrees and so forth. On the other hand, based on how angry he was at what his Philadelphia Academy had turned into, I think he'd be upset, and I say this as an English professor, with all due respect, I think he'd be upset at the deviation from what he would call practical learning and practical knowledge, and that there's an odd division we have in our university systems now where if you're going to go and study Shakespeare or creative writing, which is what I teach, you aren't going to have time to learn how to hang windows, right? And I always tell my students, you'd probably be better off hanging windows in your off time than working at for a rideshare company or a large e-commerce place in their warehouse, because it is true that he who hath a trade hath an estate, as Franklin wrote. And, you know, it does, I think Franklin would be upset or disappointed, I should say, that sort of practical knowledge, that skilled labor is missing. It's not missing, though. That's the thing. It's just unseen. But I think he'd be most upset that young people who decide not to go to a four-year university are somewhere outside the mainstream. You know, in the book, I have an alarming statistic that it's and I'm sure this is always fluctuating, but at the time when, you know, last year it was 54% of Americans identify as working class, less than 3% of those Americans are in Congress. 3% of Americans identify as millionaires. They would form the majority of Congress right now. So our streams have crossed. And, you know, at the end of the day, Franklin endowed this money or left this money behind because he really wanted tradespeople to be involved in governing our country.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Without spoiling too much in your book, and as much as you're comfortable to share while still whetting the appetite of people who want to go out and purchase it, what happened in 1991 with the payout and the windfall to be spent on civic improvements?
It was a mess. It really was both cities waking up and going, holy cow, we have all this money coming to us. Like, we forgot all about this. Because for decades, you know, the money had been, oh gosh, there's so many lawsuits. This is such an American story. And I do not let the lawsuits bog down the book. But Franklin's heirs are coming out of the woodwork saying, we need a piece of that money. You're managing it incorrectly. And different trustees are suing other trustees, and mayors are suing other people trying to get a hold of the money and steer it to different purposes. When 1991 comes around, both cities are really surprised that this is coming to them, and they kind of don't know what to do. This is at a time, you know, some listeners will remember when, you know, government malfeasance was all the rage. I mean, this is when we were finding out that screws were being purchased by our government for $32 and toilet seats for $324, and deficit spending had just become the norm. And this is when the debt clock, you know, went up in Manhattan by an upset business person. It was like, I'm going to track, you know, by the second, the interest on our debt and what our national debt is from this profligacy. So at the time, you know, there was this real concern that these cities were just going to take Franklin's money and use it to write off their own debt. And then there was a backlash, and there was a large outcry in Philadelphia, especially about, wait a minute, what are we doing with this? And how can we steer it to? In Boston, the fight was really about, should we invest in the trade school that part of this money was used to fund, or should it go to something else? And so that was a big battle as well, because back in the 1950s, during the space race, after Sputnik flew over, Boston had this great idea, these Boston politicians, that we should take all of Franklin's money and use it to fund the space race, you know, to beat the Soviets. And so at the time, a judge had said, well, no, this money was promised in 1991. Well, in 1991, those same politicians or their forebears, you know, their followers came along and said, no, this money was promised to us back in the 1950s to do X, Y, and Z, you know, as the Soviet Union was crumbling around them. And so it became a rather furious fight over what should happen to the money.
Right. I mean, we said earlier that Franklin didn't have perfect foresight. Nobody does. But it's almost as if he was playing a practical joke from beyond the grave and trying to mess with the civic leaders of these different cities by leaving a bunch of money, but not a clear plan of execution. So it sounds like Knives Out with different family members trying to kill each other over the inheritance or something similar happening.
I love that idea, because when he died, he was not friendly with his fellow founders. You know, he was friendly with George Washington, but they were distant at that time. And Thomas Jefferson, he was friendly with. But the Federalists themselves were his sworn enemies at that moment. And he couldn't even get his Paris expenses reimbursed. I absolutely think that he put this Easter egg in his will
in addition to many other things in his will. And the book goes through, you know, his pointed bequest to remind his fellow founders of his late in life turn to abolitionism, his belief that women should own property. This is a half century before coverture rules were rescinded, coverture laws were rescinded in Pennsylvania. You know, he gets Easter egg after Easter egg in his will, showing, I think, his fellow, he knew his will was going to be published, saying, these are my beliefs and I want these passed down. And I think he really loved the idea that in 100 years and in 200 years, I'm going to make headlines again and people remember what I left behind. And in the book, I compare this will to what Jefferson and Hamilton and Washington and Adams and Madison leave behind. You know, Franklin, A, he was one of the few founders to die solvent. And B, he definitely had the most progressive vision going forward. And I think he wanted, you know, future Americans to remember that. Like, hey, I'm a little bit different than these folks. I'm not landed gentry. I didn't own a plantation. I ended up taking up the cause of abolition and presenting the first petition to abolish slavery to the Senate. This is after he and his family had owned slaves intermittently across the decades. I think Franklin very much wanted to distance himself from his fellow founders with this.
We've touched on this a little bit, but to tie up this bet, what do you think Franklin would make of the legacy of his wager of bequeathing this first two lump sums and then the final payout? Do you think he would have been happy with it? Do you think he would have had mixed feelings or something else?
I think he would, you know, rather than the final outcome, I think he would relish the process. And this is something you just alluded to. I mean, in a weird way, I feel like I was writing this book for him. And that's bizarre, I know. But what I mean is, as I was learning the story, I kept thinking to myself, oh, he would love this. He would love this fight in City Hall over his idea. He would love these editorials. He would love what this working class person pointedly told a politician about how important this money was to him. I think he would really relish that. And I think he would love, you know, he wouldn't like the lawsuits. Workmen without tools are lawyers without fools, as he once said. He did not enjoy lawyers. I think he wouldn't have been surprised at that either. You know, John Adams was a lawyer and Franklin well knew the doings of lawyers and how many lawyers there were even at the turn of the 18th century going to the 19th century. But would he be happy with the way it ended up? Yeah, I think he would. I think he'd be just as shocked, though, at this new vocabulary we have of the gig economy and freelancing and these words that say, you know, no contract, zero contract hours and so forth. They sound so freeing, don't they? It just sounds like we've been liberated as workers. And I think he'd be shocked at this so-called new economy and the little protections it offers to workers. And he'd probably be telling people, why don't you learn how to make a table? Why don't you learn how to frame a door? You know, why don't you do something useful that you can set your own hours and be your own boss? Why don't you learn to code? It could extend to that as well.
Well, I always thought that in many ways, Franklin is one of the most relevant founding fathers. And the fact that he could leave behind a trust that would still be relevant hundreds of years after his death speaks strongly to that. Well, there's a lot we couldn't get into here, but seeing the details of how his bet plays out, I think would be really fascinating to look at. And for listeners who want to check that out, the name of the book is Benjamin Franklin's Last Bet, The Favorite Founding Father's Divisive Death, Enduring Afterlife, and Blueprint for American Prosperity. Michael, thank you for joining us.
It was an honor. Thanks, Scott.
All right. That is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.